say that we, the Senate was in a caucus meeting, and so therefore we cannot formally open because we don't have a quorum on the Senate side, not the House side's business, so forgive me. But we do want to get started on time since this is a big hearing and it's going to take some time for us to get through this budget, and I want to make sure that you had the opportunity to ask all questions that you wanted to ask regarding this budget. Welcome back, Tina. It's good to see you back. And what we will do is hear from Ms. Baker to give us an oversight of the bill, and then we will call the respective persons to the desk.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, today we will be starting the Department of Human Services budget with the Children, Adults, and Families program area, and a subset of that program area is the self-sufficiency program. So we will spend this week with testimony on self-sufficiency programs, including public testimony planned for Thursday of this week. Then next week we will do child welfare, so that's child protective services, foster care, and then the adoptions programs, all within the child welfare area. And the week following that we will do vocational rehabilitation. Those are all pieces of the children, adults, and families budget. So with that, I would, I guess, turn it over to you.
Okay. We have Ms. Ramona. Ms. Ramona and those that she calls with her. Chair Carter and members of the committee, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director with the Department of Human Services over an area called Children, Adults, and Families. And as Sheila has indicated, we start this week with our self-sufficiency programs, and next week we'll do child welfare, and then we'll do vocational rehabilitation. And on the 28th, right now, we're scheduled to have the discussion about the field in CAF, and so we're going to hold that kind of to last, but welcome any questions or issues you'd like us to bring forward at that time. As we said when we testified on the 23rd of January for the overview, the mission of Children, Adults, and Families is to improve family capacity to be self-sustaining while at the same time creating safe and permanent living arrangements for children. So it's a large mission, and as you can see, it has multifacets within that mission. The goals are not only to help people find and keep jobs, advance to better employment, but the goal is also to be able to protect children and, if at all possible, promote those children staying within their own families and staying there safely. Another goal is to increase competitive job placements and increase wages for persons with disabilities. We'll be talking about some of that today, but also when we do the vocational rehabilitation presentation. When children can't remain safely at home, the goal of CAF and of DHS is to try to find permanent, safe living arrangements for those children. We'll talk about that next week. We also provide accurate and timely benefits for Oregonians as they work towards family stability and economic independence, so things like food stamps, TANF benefits, employment-related daycare, those kinds of benefits. We hope to try to prevent another generation of public assistance, so it's always the goal to try to help people become self-sufficient. We think that's one of the keys to family preservation, actually. A family can stay together much better if there is a living wage in that family, keeping people safe, keeping children safe, and keeping families employed. We also expand program partnerships and address cultural competency in our programs. And one of the questions that did come up during the 23rd that we will have our administrative division take on is the question around diversity in the workforce and how we are addressing that. So that will be coming up in the next couple of weeks. You have before you our document, and I'm on page 2. And I'm not going to go into the history there, but you have sort of a capsule of the history of these programs, and we did cover that on the 23rd. So I wanted to call on John Swanson for just a moment. You've got a high-level budget pie chart there on pages 4 and 5.
Chair Carter and committee members, my name is John Swanson. I'm the administrator with the Finance and Policy Unit for the department. And yes, we have presented this information earlier, but I wanted to put a little bit of half-level information just to give you a context as you're starting to hear these program areas as to how they fit into the division. The first chart basically just shows you the size of each of these program areas as you're going to be talking about them in terms of total funds. And on the top of page 5, then, it gives you a sense of how much federal funds are in each of these programs relative to general and other. The last chart there gives you an idea of some of the packages that comprise the general fund budget for this division. And I just wanted to mention that in Addenda 1, in the back of here, is more detail on that as we start looking at it. But those packages and information will be discussed in detail in the program discussions. The other comment I'd like to make is we've attempted to lay this document out as best we could around the instructions that we've gotten, but our real aim is to provide relevant, useful information to the committee, and I would like any feedback we can get from members as to how we can make this more useful as we go along, and maybe we can make some improvements as we go. So
if you look on pages 4 and 5, the one comment I would ask you to think about as we go through these presentations over the next couple of weeks is that you see that CAF has a heavy reliance on federal funds. And what that generally means to us is there are a lot of restrictions. There are some things we would like to be able to do, but we have to be compliant with federal laws and regulations. And that's generally one of the things we will talk about as we go through the various programs. So we have some flexibility, but not total flexibility. Moving on here.
Senator Gordley, please. Thank you. I'm going to pretend that Senator Winters is here. I know she's listening. And just want to ask early on in the presentation if we could not use acronyms.
Oh, yes.
That would be very helpful to me, and I know it would be helpful to the new members of our Human Services.
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, I will keep that in mind. I miss Rosie that pig. You know, we used to put a dollar in there every time we used one of those acronyms.
It kind
of
reminds you, huh?
Yes. Thanks for reminding me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
On page 6, you see just an overview. Again, this is the information we shared on the 23rd about the size of the services we do, the number of clients served, and so forth. And we'll be picking that up in each of the program presentations. And on page 7, you see the various programs that Sheila Baker has discussed and reminded us we'll be going through these, with one addition at the bottom on the 28th. That's when we have our wrap-up session, and again, we'll talk about the field structure. On page 8, you actually see our organizational structure for CAF. That's the entire thing, a snapshot of the entire picture. As of January of 07, we have 4,072 FTE, which is full-time equivalent. That means staff. And you can see sort of the layout of where those staff are, the majority, of course, being in the field, where the services are for the most part delivered across the Department of CAF. So I'm going to then draw your attention, because Vic Todd will be joining us, so we can start with the self-sufficiency part of the presentation. But you have a document, I believe, that looks like this. And we just gave this out. This is sort of, I call it a cheat sheet, but it's kind of the outline of how we're going to go through each of the programs. Because there are some of you on this committee who know these programs well enough you could probably do the presentation. And there are others who will be learning more about these programs as we go through. And then some that will just be being updated on some of the programs. So we try to kind of find the common denominator. And so what we will talk about in each program is what the services are that are provided, where those services are located here in the state, who receives the services, how they're delivered, why these services are significant to Oregonians, and then we'll move directly. That'll be a short summary of these programs, and then moving directly to the performance measures. I know that there's a lot of interest in how we're doing on the performance measures, both the key performance measures as well as other outcome measures, how we compare to other states in this regard, what are the quality and efficiency improvements that we made in these programs, and then lastly, we finish up in each program area around the 07-09 budget summary. What are those key budget drivers? What are the reductions that we're looking at? and what are the policy option packages. And again, as John said, if you find as we go through this there's an easier way to convey this, please let us know. But we thought this might be a way to get started, and we can just see how it goes rather than having you all. One of my goals is always not to have the committee have to flip pages back and forth from one part of the book to the other. So hopefully what you will see under your first tab on self-sufficiency is the layout that we've just described for the document outline.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, I'm Vic Todd, Administrator for Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs, and with me today is David Leida, who is the TANF Program Manager. And so what we're going to do is we'll start on page 9 of your document. Self-sufficiency program areas are really programs designed to provide assistance for very low-income families. And the major programs within that program area include temporary assistance for needy families, sometimes referred to as TANF, the food stamps program, child care, and refugee assistance. The CAS self-sufficiency area is also responsible for performing a large portion of the medical assistance eligibility. And so that's performed throughout the various branch offices. As you can see, the governor's budget for the self-sufficiency programs is about $1.4 billion. And that's primarily driven by the food stamp program, which is $987.9 million, followed by the TANF-related programs, which include the domestic violence, TANF basic and UN programs, and finally the jobs program. Child care is also a fairly large program at $134.1 million. Moving to the next page, this is really, again, a depiction of the funding mix within self-sufficiency. And what you can see there is that the self-sufficiency programs are very much federal fund driven. While it shows a 10% general fund, the other funds are predominantly made up of child care development funds, sometimes referred to as CCDF. Those funds come to us through the Employment Department, so we receive them as other funds. But
Mr. Todd, can you just wait for a minute? Members, this is the for real deal, so you can feel free to ask questions as you go. We don't have to wait until the end because we fine-tune this. So should you have any questions, just call my attention if I'm looking the wrong way at the wrong time. Thank you.
Thank you. So what I was saying was that the self-sufficiency programs are driven largely by federal funds and federal program requirements. The pie chart at the bottom depicts all other funds, but that actually is child care development funds. It was just entered into the wrong budget category, and so it came out as other. So just want to clarify that.
Just to clarify, the funding that comes through the Employment Department originates from the federal government?
Yes.
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, that's correct.
And is it part of the unemployment? Where does it come from in the federal government? Is it just an appropriation out of their general fund, or is it a bleed off of a dedicated funding source?
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, the Child Care Development Fund was actually a part of the original legislation that is often referred to as welfare reform back in 1996, where they consolidated some different federal funding streams and created this one Child Care Development Fund. It is federal funds, and as part of that legislation, each state had to designate what agency was the lead agency for the state. And Oregon identified the Employment Department because of the workforce connection. as the lead agency. And so while we deliver the employment-related daycare program using those child care development fund funds, the money actually flows through the employment department.
May I have one more question, Madam Chair? The federal appropriation, is it just so much for each state, or is it based on enrollment in the program? What governs the amount of money?
Senator Carter, Representative Morgan, each state is allocated a certain amount of federal dollars from the larger child care development federal appropriation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that a little bit, the Child Care and Development Fund is a capped block grant to the state. It's not an entitlement where we get X number of matching dollars for X dollars of general fund that we put in. So it's a limited amount, and as you'll see here, that influences the budget later on.
So, Ms. Baker, this does not have a match component to it?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, correct. There is a maintenance of effort requirement similar to the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program, but it's not a case where if we put in a dollar, we get $3 back.
Do you know what maintenance of effort is? Because you're going to hear that like 5,000 times.
Well, I think the thing that is important is that Representative Morgan, all of these would be surrounded by our performance measures, so they just can't get money into the state and use it as they will. Not only is there the maintenance of effort, but there's also a performance measure that we have along this line. Ms. Cote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Speaking of maintenance of effort, will we be getting a report on the state's maintenance of effort for the various requirements that we do have? Is that part of knowing how we are meeting our maintenance of effort, either in TANF or any other programs?
That's a good question. Do we do this?
Procedurally, have we done it?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, the agency can address that as we're going through the various programs, both to talk about how we're doing currently and then when we get to the governor's budget discussion, what the expectation would be relative to those maintenance of effort requirements.
Let me say, I know I saw Dr. Goldberg a few minutes ago, but let me say in terms of your department, you can disseminate the message to him that any program that we have where the minimum of maintenance of effort is involved, we'd like to hear the success of that maintenance of effort in terms of the government, how we are responding to the service area in which you're delivering as it relates to maintenance of effort.
Thank you, Chair Carter.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Well, no, I'm sorry.
Senator Marshall.
I guess I'm kind of curious about all the possible maintenance of effort programs that we have and which ones we're not using. I mean, we do have some choices, right?
We have choices
of which programs we will count as maintenance of effort. Is that correct?
Senator Carter, Senator Morissette, that is correct the state is allowed to identify particular areas of programs that fit the definitions under which maintenance of effort can be counted. So that can occur outside of CAF, for example.
Okay. Well, I guess my question is, of the programs that we are currently funding are selected as maintenance of effort, what other programs are possible? I mean, are we selecting the right ones? Do we revisit this periodically?
Senator Carter and Senator Morissette, we revisit it frequently. It is an ongoing issue, and while the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 opened up some new potential areas, it is always a challenge for us to ensure that we've met those.
Okay, one more question. I guess my bottom line question, is this a departmental decision? Is this legislative oversight? Is it both? Are we going to have some opportunity to give input in the new federal regs? Or is that something that you guys do as a matter of course?
Senator Carter and Senator Morissette, this actually what we are bringing forward as part of this presentation will be a policy package that does address the proposed changes that we see that we would like to make, and that is for, you know, discussion in this forum, obviously. So
it appears to me also that your question is a little broad in the sense that what you're asking is how does the department determine what dollars you're going to use for what programs, or do you prioritize, or you look at a need that we have in the state, for instance, child care. You and I both know that child care came up in the 80s for those people who were returning to college, and that we were helping them to go on with that program. Did you determine that need based, did you determine child care based upon the need of the citizens that you provide provide services to, or how do you determine that, the kinds of program services you're going to deliver?
Senator Carter, the approach that's really taken is that the department develops proposals, and ultimately the legislature determines what those priorities are going to be.
Okay, that was your question.
Well,
Senator Morrison.
Yeah. There are new possibilities. The new Deficit Reduction Act opens up new possibilities to the states. Is that correct?
Senator Carter, Senator Morrison. Yes, that's okay. Correct.
That's what I'm interested in. What new possibilities are there? Well, at some point, we'll probably be talking about that.
Senator Carter, Senator Morissette, yes, we will. Okay. We will be talking about those opportunities and challenges that that act has presented for us.
Okay, thank you, thank you.
Page 11 is again, just another depiction of the different federal fund sources within the self-sufficiency area. And as you can see, the food stamps program, because it is 100% federal funds, it uses most of that. I'm going to turn to the TANF section, which is on page 13. Temporary Assistance for Needy Families is a program that is intended to provide financial assistance for very low-income families. And within Oregon, the families, and we tend to use a family size of three when we describe the income criteria and payment standards. And for within Oregon, the current income threshold for eligibility is $616 a month, and the monthly payment level for a family of three that has no income is $514 a month. That represents about 36% of the federal poverty level guideline income thresholds. In the next section, referred to as the where service recipients are located, that will appear in each of these sections for the different programs, so I won't stop at each one of those, and Jim Neely will talk more about that in detail. The item I did want to point out to you is that on the next page, which is the chart on page 14, in each of the program areas, I will refer back to this particular page rather than put this chart in each section. We're just referring back to it. But it shows you for the various programs where or the numbers of people that are served by county. Within the TANF program, approximately 18,000 families receive services. That includes 41,000 people in total and includes about 30,000 children. During fiscal year 06, the average number of families was 18,298 who received TANF cash assistance. The TANF program is funded with a federal block grant, and as part of the requirements around that, the state is required to provide a maintenance of effort. And we've somewhat discussed that already. But a maintenance of effort is essentially that the federal government has picked a time period upon which to base the requirements of the state to spend at the same level, essentially. And that is what they refer to as maintenance of effort. So for the TANF program, that is an ongoing issue for us. Again, on page 14 is the chart depicting where the services are delivered and the numbers of people. The cash benefits for the cannabis cash assistance clients are distributed using the electronic benefits transfer system, sometimes referred to as the Oregon Trail Card. That's true for both the cash assistance on TANF and then also the food stamp.
Excuse me for a minute, Representative.
I just have a quick question. On the bottom of page 13, it says adults who receive TANF assistance generally are expected to participate in the jobs, employment, and training. So then on the figures over here, let's take CLASSIP for an example, and TANF persons at 266, is that the three people in the family, including children, and because the jobs participants is 58. Is that what that's reflecting?
Chair Carter and Representative Boone, that is the total number of people. So that includes adults and children.
Okay, thanks.
So on page 15, we talk about why these services are significant for Oregonians. Again, this particular program, this particular portion of the program provides a cash benefit for very low-income families, and it's really a partial means to address the financial stability issues for these families. Within the TANF program, there are a very small number of families who are on the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program who actually have any income. About 98% of the families have zero income. At this point now, we'll start talking about the various performance measures within the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, and what we'll see is that a lot of these same measures relate to the jobs program, and so we won't come back and rediscuss them, but just to let you see that. And what we have are really two key performance measures, four existing outcome measures, and then four new measures that we are going to begin to use as a result of some of the changes that we're proposing within the governor's budget. The first key performance measure number five, is the percent of TANF adults placed for whom employment is a goal. And that really is referring to the mandatory participants within the program.
One question. So in this group of people you're talking about, the others are those who have some level of disability and unable to work?
Senator Carter, Chair Carter, essentially it is those that are exempt for a reason that make them not a mandatory participant.
Okay.
This measure reflects really the ability of DHS and its partners' capacity to help people served on TANF to become employed. And as you can see, the goal is 11.1%, and as of 2005, the achieved level was 8.3%. One of the issues here for us is that in essentially all of our measures, what you'll see at the bottom of the page is that we have a comment there saying that based upon performance, we are going to be coming back to propose new targets next biennium. And in some cases, we would probably suggest changing some of these measures to be more reflective.
Madam Chair, say your point, please.
Thank you very much. If we could just stop for a moment here, and could you tell us how employment is defined? I'm reading and understand that it's employment that is 30 hours or more a month, but within that definition, what else are we looking for in terms of employment? Are we looking for family wage jobs, living wage jobs? Within the numbers that you're presenting to us, how do we tease out that information, or can you illustrate that information for us? I'll stop there and continue after you respond.
Senator Carter, Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, you touched on an issue that I wanted to speak to, actually, and with respect to this measure, that and the issue of is how do you know when they actually are employed. Mm-hmm. And what we've experienced over the years is certain weaknesses in that definition that's been used. And so what we're really moving towards is, first, before we identify it as a placement, to ensure that we can then see within our own system that earnings begin to show up and or the case status changes, meaning that the case cash benefits end and they move to ERDC, employment-related daycare, or some other action that demonstrates that, in fact, employment did occur. Often we will get information from a client saying that they have gotten a job, and that may be recorded as a placement, and in fact they may not actually ever start that job. So we want to be sure that that we're only recording those for which employment actually does occur. And so that's why this both the goal and the outcome will move around as we tighten that definition.
Thank you. What I'd like to have a better picture of with your help is, it's one goal to have people getting a job that then allows them to earn their way off of cash assistance. That's one thing. It's quite another thing to have people find employment that allows them to earn their way out of poverty, to earn their way toward, again, that living wage, family wage, employment that allows families to do more than survive, to thrive. So what does that picture look like within the numbers that you're presenting to us, and how are you tracking that experience?
Let me just piggyback on Senator Gordon's question, because I do know in past times there were people who were on TANF and they go off for employment, but they still are receiving food stamps. So who's totally off and who's totally successful in terms of family wage jobs that help pay for medical, and that they're not on government services at all?
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, that is the most complicated question, in that the TANF program is, the population that is being worked with there, by and large, has little work experience. And so it is an issue in terms of the family wage jobs and the ability to have jobs that have benefits and so forth. In many cases, though, this really is their first experience with a sustained employment. So in some of the other measures that we have, we look at wage progression and compare entry level for TANF clients as related to the rest of the workforce entry, things like that. But what we don't do at this point really is look to see that progression in terms of at what point did these people stop using food stamps and so forth.
Does that get to your question, Senator?
Partially, because there's a workforce component as well that I'm wondering about. And I think what I'll do is just allow you to continue your conversation with us and come back to this point.
Yeah. Are there further questions?
On page 16, we wanted to, on these measures, be able to look at how Oregon compares to other states. And in some instances, we're able to do that. In many instances, we're not, because the measure is unique to Oregon. One of the ways that we are able to look at how Oregon compares to other states as it relates to the Key Performance Measure 5 is to look at the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, federal level high performance bonus information that has been produced. Although that has been discontinued, it is one area that we can look at. And also I'll get to that in a second here. The first table is looking at data related to 2004 for various states, and what jumps out at you is Oregon is listed there as 50th in terms of job entry rate. And the caveat there that I think we have to keep in mind whenever we look at any of these comparisons is the variability of program pieces that each state has. And one of the elements that Oregon has is the assessment process that actually goes on prior to a TAMP case opening, and many of our placements occur within that. And so it skews kind of Oregon's placement on this scale somewhat. Oregon has...
Excuse me for my hand.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to follow you as closely as I can. And obviously, Oregon ranked 50th did jump out at me. But I just listened to your explanation, and I feel like I'm dizzy. I couldn't follow what you were telling me was the reason we were ranked 50th other than processing.
Chair Carter, Representative Barrage, what I was trying to lay out, not very well apparently.
At least for one member,
okay. That's all. Is that for these placements, it's looking at cases, families that are on cash assistance. And in Oregon, we have a process that tries to help people not need to go on cash assistance. And we do about 20% of our placements occur in that assessment element. And so they wouldn't be counted in this count when they look at job entry. And so it tends to understate. It's not, I'm not trying to make a judgment about how far up Oregon would move in that. The piece I think that's important in terms of the high performance bonus is that Oregon has received about $9 million related to high performance bonus outcome. And so while if you look at this particular measure, you'd say, well, that's really bad. In fact, when across the spectrum, Oregon has done very well in terms of high performance bonus. And so as we talk through some of these others, Oregon will be ranked in other places and so forth.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's also important to recognize that, unlike other states, we have not increased our income eligibility since, I believe, 1991. So for individuals who are working, half-time at minimum wage, they may too much to be on TANF. And other states have much higher income eligibility. They have more job-ready individuals coming into their TANF program than we might have. We, literally have folks who have basically nothing. They have no income, generally, even to get on the program. So we might have a population of folks with much higher needs by the way we structure our program. So that also affects our numbers.
I think it's what Senator Carter was trying to
add. The success ratio, the numbers of people who are actually getting skilled opportunity to be able to move up the ladder rather than just to be off cash assistance.
And just a quick follow-up. I think this is an important. The whole understanding of our current population will be important when we get to the redesign discussion of who is still on the program and what kind of services they need to move them into the jobs and self-sufficiency that we're all talking about. So, I think we are unique compared to other states in terms of how our program, the status of our population that's actually in the program right now, is a lot different than other states.
Mm-hmm. A question that comes to mind is, again, if we're talking about moving a person off of cash assistance into employment, what if the step that's needed before employment is a skill that one could gain at a community college? And so I'm looking for where that fits, where how that need gets addressed and where that number factors into the chart that you're showing us on page 15. Not everybody's ready to go get a job. So what about the folks who may need a skill at a community college, and where is that number within what you're presenting to us? Or does that number not exist? Am I?
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, I think that's part of the challenge for this program, and you know, serving this population, that it is a bigger challenge than just the TANF jobs program by itself. It's a workforce issue. There's training needs, and so forth. And so, to the degree that this program is enabled to do that, and the degree completion initiative is an example of that, that's a limited recognition of that need. But I think that is a challenge, and one that's continually struggled with, you know, as a state, in terms of that resource being put in place. Issue.
So I guess the question, Madam Chair, is, and how is the challenge being addressed currently within the temporary assistance to needy families program? You have that client who presents not as ready for employment, but needs to gain a skill or skills at a community college in order to be able to move into employment. What happens?
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Leida. I am the program manager with Children, Adults, and Families TANF program. Currently, we run program called the Degree Completion Initiative. And what that does is it allows up to 100 participants at a time to complete a year of college on their way to getting a degree. Now, the way that the program works is that you're allowed to do that for up to a year, and that meets your jobs, the job opportunity and basic skills employment training programs requirements for up to that year, and then when, as access allows, we periodically open that up to be within 2 years of completing your degree that you can utilize that program.
And that's a good question, but I think what most of us are trying to find out, within the framework of your TANF program, since you use the term self-sufficiency, if there are people, that 98% that you say are basically employable, or I think I read 98%, of that group that are become employable, do you try to send any of them at all to, say, a community college or to some of the skill-based versus proprietary or whatever? Do you try to send those people to get the skill they need to come out of poverty, or do some of them just go on a job track where they're getting on-the-job training? What do you do? How do you lift these people out of poverty?
Chair Carter, members of the committee, we have some services for vocational training and job skills training, as well as a lot of the barrier removal activities, mental health, A&D, domestic violence assessments, and job readiness skills. Really, within the whole poverty question, it's really, I guess, if you look at the entire workforce system within Oregon, not just the jobs program, there's, you know, a number of agencies, including employment and community college workforce development, that address kind of different segments with some crossover of the population to help move people forward. I think within that grander system, we tend, well, our programs, because of the low countable income standard and income threshold to come into the program, and when we talk about the 98%, that's you know, a very few number of people. It's approximately 250 of the adults that are actually recipients on our TANF grants have earnings each month. Now, there's a little less than 40% of our grants that are child-only grants, and those are where we're paying a caretaker relative to take care of that. But I hope that kind of addresses it.
So, within the framework of TANF itself, it's not a program in terms of self-sufficiency when you allow people to go to school or anything else. It's just job readiness kind of stuff.
Chair Carter, I think you're absolutely right. I'm listening to this conversation, and I don't think we should try to convey that TANF currently is something more than what it is. When you go back and look at the enabling legislation that passed in 1996, it doesn't really speak to trying to move families out of poverty. What it speaks to is getting somebody a job. And we've had years of experience now where getting someone a job doesn't necessarily ensure that they're going to move up the ladder, that they're going to be out of poverty, they're going to be able to keep their family together or keep their kids safe. I think, going back to the original comments, I think that's some of the opportunity that lies before this committee during this session to try to determine, can we do a better job of what TANF ultimately should do? But I do think we're doing it kind of in the absence of the federal support that really many people think the TANF program originally was to move people out of poverty. And again, it's a misnomer because it can't do that, especially if you are receiving $514 a month for yourself and two children. You're trying to get into school to go longer than 1 year. You're trying to get into some kind of higher training or education. So I just felt the need to just say that we don't want to try to trick you into thinking this is something about an anti-poverty program.
That's what I was thinking. You need to take self-sufficiency. Senator, you follow up with your question, then Senator Morissette.
Okay, I just want to understand. Again, just seeking clarity. Then is the degree completion initiative that we heard referenced, is that a part of TANF as it is currently being rolled out, or is it a separate piece? And I also heard that 100 people at a time get into the initiative. What does that mean, 100 people at a time, 100 people a quarter, 100 people a year? How are they selected for that initiative versus channeling people into just employment?
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, that program is capped at a 100 clients that can be in the program at a time. People apply to be in that program, listing out the vocational goal they have for their program, and that's an application that comes through central office and we review.
Chair Carter, I think that this is an example of a program area that, from a federal perspective, is not a countable activity.
Right.
And so you start getting into this issue of what activities do you have people in, which makes sense, versus what is countable.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the challenge to this. And so that's why that program element is as limited as it is because of the participation requirements for the federal program.
That's good clarification. Senator Morissette, then Ms. Nathanson.
That's very helpful to understand because I see two aspects. One is the humanitarian effort to keep people alive. But that begs the question of the next step. And I hope that we do some tracking, and I would hope that maybe under our new plan we do some longitudinal studies. Or in fact, I don't know why we can't do that anyway. If you have the record of all of the people who've ever been involved in TANF and just find out how many of them have gone on and succeeded, that would be really good information. But at least I hope that we get into that, maybe some performance measures and of tracking people to see if we really are doing the right thing. You know, maybe some small tweaks in the program could move people along. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that in human services, as well as in the criminal justice system, I hear an awful lot of stories about how we help people a little bit for a short amount of time and then drop them. Mm-hmm. And then they have to come back again. We help them again a little bit, and then we drop them. Mm-hmm. There's a terrible cycle of ups and downs for that individual or for that family, and it doesn't necessarily always result in a permanent betterment for that family. Given that, you know, what counts toward a work activity, I understand that in the TANF program, specifically by itself, maybe you can't pull this off, but do you all, I almost said y'all, we'll have to chat later. Do you have active discussions with either community colleges or public or private, whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit training programs or community services, about whether TANF clients are first in line for certain kinds of services and certain kinds of scholarships? Now, I understand if they're first in line, someone else drops off the list and has to wait a little longer. But if TANF clients were first in line and could get other help for longer periods of time, especially training, and then too, as the senators have been pointing out, maybe more permanent types of helpful activities, maybe you wouldn't have to see them again as clients.
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, we have many partners, many of whom are community colleges, and so there is a lot of activity in trying to help these people. And what you're suggesting is, you know, it does make sense on certain levels. And you do get into the issue of, well, who moves to second place and so forth. But these, as Representative Protek indicated, the income thresholds for Oregon are fairly low, and so the client group that we have are very challenged in terms of employment. And often that is just that first employment is a major challenge. So there is a continuum there, but it's oftentimes it is that first employment that you're trying to get in place.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just several comments and then a quick question. In the Degree Completion Initiative, just for those who've been around a while, that's the that's what developed out of the Parents of Scholars Bill passed in 2003. So, in terms of countable activities, where we get into education, whether that's a countable activity, it might not be from the federal government's perspective, but we could count it here. It's just a matter of what funding stream is going to pay for it. So we just need to keep that in mind, I think. And on the performance measures, I'm glad to see that you have some, and I assume we're going to get to those, you have some proposed performance measures, which I think are going to be critical as we redesign the program to really see if the program is actually producing the outcomes we want. A lot of your performance measures over the years have been a lot of outputs, and I think we're trying to move to outcomes, so I'm glad to see that you're proposing some changes. And I was wondering, did you do a policy option package on increasing both the income threshold and the benefit level? And if you didn't, could you get me the numbers of what it would be if we actually increased the income threshold and the benefit level? Because as I've mentioned, we have not increased either since 1991, and I think it would be helpful to get a sense of it might cost us some money, but that might be an option that we want to consider.
Chair Carter, Representative Protek, was in the governor's budget that a proposal to increase either of those categories is not included. There is an inflationary increase, general inflationary increase of 3.1%. But in terms of addressing those thresholds, that is not. So but we can talk with you separately and get you information.
Thank you.
We're just going to push you a bit so that we can get to the other performance measures which are tied to the budget.
With that, then I will move to Key Performance Measure 6, which is on page 17. This performance measure looks at the percent of TANF cases that are not on assistance 18 months after they become employed. This particular measure does not look at whether they were on in the interim, but just looks at that point later. And we'll come back to this a little bit in that we have a separate outcome measure that we want to use to measure the subset of this group. Again, this is another measure that tries to look at whether or not when these clients do become employed, are they able to sustain their employment. And what we have experienced in the last few years is seeing a greater proportion of these clients actually returning. And so that's an issue that we're looking to address in what we're going to propose.
I would say that this measure reflects what I was talking about earlier in terms of the origin of the TANF program. The idea was to get people into a job, and this measure has been around for years, and it simply looks at whether or not that person is still there 18 months later. And it doesn't account for all the kinds of things that can happen to families. For example, they may not be on TANF because the children came into foster care. So I think as we look at newer outcome measures and ways to really measure what's happening with families, it may be a lot more helpful than this particular measure that gives you just a snapshot but really doesn't tell you where the family is.
On page 18, we look at how Oregon compares to other states. Again, this is a measure that's unique to Oregon. But in using the high-performance data, what we see there in terms of what was reported is Oregon was ranked at 39th, and the U.S. average being just slightly higher than Oregon. I'll move now to what we're referring to as other the outcome measures for TANF, which are not the key performance measures, but just our own outcome measures. The first one is the number of TANF cases per 1,000 Oregonians, and we use that to look at the relative success of families not needing public assistance in Oregon. And as you can see in the table on page 19, that currently, as of 2006, Oregon had a rate of 4.8 per 1,000 Oregonians. I'll note that this is cases as opposed to persons, because when we move to the comparison of other states, it's actually on a person basis. At any rate, the goal for the next biennium is to be under the 5.4. So, again, this is one we would come back and revisit in terms of a revised goal. The comparison to other states, Oregon on a person basis is 11 per 1,000, and you can see how it relates to the other states there, with the U.S. average being 13.7. Next measure is total placements per month, so this is actual count. While the key performance measure 5 looks at the proportion of the mandatory adults who are placed, this actually looks at the absolute number. Again, this will be affected by that definition shift that we're going to do. And with what we're proposing in the 07-09 budget, we would want to revisit these as we move towards the 9/11 biennium. State comparisons, that's really, we covered that under Key Performance 5. The next measure, average hourly beginning wage for full-time jobs placements. This, again, reflects how successful the DHS and its partners are in terms of helping people to get employed higher than minimum wage jobs. The chart on page 21 is showing relative performance. Again, this is an area that we want to relook at the target and really make the target a little bit more dynamic rather than using it, having a flat line there. So tie it to some other, a minimum wage plus a percentage or something so that target will move by itself. And look looking at how we can compare to other states, we really couldn't find any comparable national data for this major. The PRISM data, which is really the system that's used for the workforce participants, this out of this system, we looked at that to do a comparison, and it's, what it showed was its starting wage for the TANF clients, temporary assistance for needy families clients, was $9.49 versus $12.43 per hour for the entire system. The next measure relates to the percentage of teen parents in school. And this is a critical issue for many reasons, in terms of moving towards self-sufficiency, both financially as well as just family stability issues, that teens who do not complete high school or complete their GED are more likely to have additional children when they're young. And so this is a key issue for us. And as you can see by the table, that we're currently, as of 06, at 90.3%, with the target just held at 100%.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cochet.
Thank you. Do you have any insights on why there's a gap? I know this has been a goal for the department for a while to make sure that the teen parents who are in the TANF program are attending school, and do you have a plan to get us closer to 100%, or is the 100% target unrealistic?
Chair Carter, representing COTEC. This is actually an issue that I've had quite a bit of discussion with the field staff around, trying to get an understanding of it. Some of it is data reporting. Some of it is the reality that these kids don't want to be in school, and it's a struggle. And so, given all those things, this is such a critical population, because left unattended, in terms of their education, they're higher probability of needing TANF for longer periods of time. So there's a lot of reasons to have a strong strategy for this, and we're working to improve that. So 90% isn't kind of the ultimate goal. We don't feel good about that. We think we should be able to move closer to the 100%. But it's a struggle.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you track whether these students complete high school or get their GED? Do you track completion rates for the program?
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, we do track to see if they do complete, because it affects those that have completed are included in the count of total teens in terms of participation. And so we do track that, both groups, both those that are should be pursuing it and those that have completed it.
So what percentage of, if I might, Madam Chair, what percentage of the students actually make it to a GED or a high school completion?
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, offhand, I don't know what that percent is, but we can get that for you.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that.
I think at this point I move to the section called Proposed Outcome Measures. And there are four of these. The first measure is a measure that we want to begin to track the issue around TANF children who move to foster care. This is a significant issue, and we think that as part of what we're proposing going forward, as part of the family stability issue, we want to try to get this number to go down. And that's really the intent. And so we're beginning to track this outcome measure. The chart on page 23 reflects the recent history around children moving to foster care. And with what we're proposing, we're looking to move that number down.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry. Representative Botta.
Thank you. I think this is an intriguing measure. I guess instead of doing children, can you do a percentage of children?
I think if you're just counting heads, I don't think you're getting at the percentage of total children in the TANF program who might be, I don't know, I'm just curious why you chose head count versus a percentage of the caseload or something like that.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, actually we went back and forth on that very issue. And we thought that numbers of children was probably a better reflection in terms of impact, because the percentage will be influenced by where your TANF caseload is in terms of the number. And so we felt that an absolute number in terms of impact was more what we would want to track. If that's clear, we can talk about that.
Okay. Thanks.
Again, in the section around how Oregon compares to other states, what we actually found was that many states don't even consider this as an issue. And so while we found a study that spoke to it, it really didn't speak to the issue of TANF families where the children ultimately moved to foster care. It was more looking at the child welfare children who are Title 40 eligible, which equates to the temporary assistance for needy families eligibility thresholds. So it was a little bit different mix. The next new measure is related to wage gain of former clients. And what is displayed there in that table is a comparison between the workforce system clients and TANF. And what this would do is look at the first quarter and fifth quarter wages to do a comparison in terms of wage increase. The goal that we would set around this would be to increase that incremental increase by 10% by the end of the 2007-09 biennium. Again, this measure is unique to Oregon in using the high performance data. You can see that earnings gain rate for Oregon, Oregon actually was ranked fourth at 64%, and the U.S. average being at roughly 37%. The next measure relates to number of state family SSI applicants who are approved by the SSA for disability benefits. This is one of those areas where we're talking about a measure before we talk about what we're proposing.
Can we go back 1 minute?
Sure.
Because if we look at the wage gain, and I think it answers some of the questions that members have been asking, it's if a person will receive a minimum wage of $7.50 an hour, and that is equivalent almost, so close to the grant amount that they receive, these increases would not allow them to be even self-sufficient without some government service. Is that right?
When
you look at page 24.
Yes.
So a person and family of three that is making $6.50 an hour minimum wage, and they have an increase in their wages by $1.12 after 90 days, 60 days, 90 days, 120 days, whatever, this will still not allow them to manage on those resources without some kind of government intervention.
Chair Carter, that's correct. And at minimum wage, if my memory serves me, you are almost, if you're working full-time, almost at 100% of poverty.
Right.
In terms of income guidelines. If you're working more than 18 hours at minimum wage, you're not eligible for TANF.
Right.
So you're correct, though, that even at those lower wages, you will still need some of the other service sets that are available, including food stamps and so forth.
So I guess we can just this isn't asking all the questions, because there's no, because I think what I've been hearing the committee was saying is that how does a person completely get off government services. And we got to go back to what Ms. Foley was just saying. So the goal is to be able to just help them to eat and feed the family, not necessarily become self-sufficient to the degree that they are off government services.
I'm asking and I'm saying.
You need to answer. No. You already have.
Thank you.
Okay. Can we get that committee? Go forward.
The measure related to SSI applicants, what we're looking to do and what's being proposed is to strengthen the efforts that we have around working with clients, the families where the adult actually should be pursuing SSI eligibility. And so this measure would address that in terms of looking to increase the numbers of people who are successful at getting their applications approved.
Okay, even though you don't have Rosie up there, I think Senator Gordley can come back and tell you, say, what SSI means. Maybe we better find us a Rosie, Senator Gordley.
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, I'll apologize. Social Security income.
Okay.
Actually, it's Supplemental Security Income. And SSA is Social Security Administration, which is regular benefits. SSI is generally for people with disabilities.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair?
Representative Grimes.
Thank you. There's another Jobs Plus program circulating in this building. Would that help you in the TANF program?
Chair Carter, Representative Garrard, actually, we in the proposal, we propose an expansion of that program.
Okay.
So, and we'll get to that.
Thank you.
Yeah, you better travel delicately in this committee on that one. Go forward.
I'm going to move to the next measure on page 26, which again is a sub-measure of the key performance measure number 6 related to clients that return to TANF. And this is really looking at having a measure that looks at the impact related to clients who never return to TANF. And what we're seeing, as I mentioned earlier, is an increase or decrease, depending on which way you look at it. And we're seeing more people return to TANF, and so fewer people who do not return to TANF. And so we want to track that in terms of the outcomes that we're going to get going forward.
Madam Chair, would you say that again?
Sorry.
I want to be clear on the point that you're making.
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, what this measure does, the key performance measure 6 is looking at almost 2 points in time and saying that 18 months after you left, were you on TANF? And so the answer to the question is a yes or no. But what it doesn't ask is, did you return to TANF in that interim and are off now? What this measure does is look at it from the standpoint of, after you left TANF, did you ever return? And this tracks the percent that did not return in that 18 months.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Cortez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm glad to see you're considering other performance measures. I think one of the things that we want to keep in mind is this program is to help children. And what's always curious to me is that the performance measures aren't really looking at the safety and welfare of the child necessarily. I think the one on foster care, it gets at some of that. But if possible to consider some performance measures, especially with the redesigned program, that actually says we have produced more stability for the child. We have that child, I think the question Representative Morgan had, are the teen parents actually finishing school? I mean, those are the kind of things that I think get us more at the types of outcomes we're wondering about. I don't have any suggestions, but if they come to me, I'll let you know.
Thank you. Okay. So maybe we'll move now to page 27 and talk a little about the quality and efficiency improvements, if that's... Within this area, the piece that I wanted to focus on within this section is really related to consistency of service delivery And the training that we have begun this past year related to...
Excuse me just for a moment. Why don't we suggest that members at for the quality and efficiency improvements of TANF, that maybe tonight you can read through that or something, or tomorrow, but that we go straight to the budget summary. If that's okay with you, we can just go straight through that, because it's just a lot of reading material. You want to do that? Let's just go straight to the 0709 budget summary of TANF.
Chair Hart, do you want to begin on page 27 or move towards...
You can go to the bottom of page 15 by the drivers and issues.
Okay. Within the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Program, the key driver is the reauthorization of the program that occurred as part of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. Within that reauthorization, there were significant changes to this program and significant redefinition or definition, if you will, around some areas that already existed. One of the big issues that occurred is really a large increase in the amount of reporting and verification required of states to the federal government, as well as a tight definitional set around activities that are countable in terms of meeting participation requirements. And while the participation requirements themselves did not change, the participation requirements for what they refer to as the all-family rate is 50%, and the two-parent families, which we in this state refer to as the UN program, the basic TANF UN, was set at 90%. In addition, this program, when it was established in 96, had a recognition of outcome, if you will, in terms of caseload reduction, and that was referred to as the caseload reduction credit. So what that meant was that for every percent reduction in your caseload, you would reduce your required participation rate by 1%. So if, for example, the all-family rate is set at 50% and you had a 10% reduction to your caseload, your effective participation rate was 40% that you needed to achieve to get to that net, or to the total of 50%. The base year was set as 1996 in terms of that caseload piece. And as part of the Deficit Reduction Act, that was changed to be, actually it was 1995, excuse me, and that was changed to 2005. And so in a state like Oregon, where we had a significant decrease in caseloads, that helped enable Oregon to operate the program that it wanted to without significant concern around meeting those federal requirements with respect to the general participation.
So does that mean that you had more flexibility in what you would count as being a part of the federal government's requirements for jobs?
Right. Both through the waiver that we had and with the caseload reductions that we had.
Okay.
With that, and that was a significant piece for many states in terms of that caseload reduction credit. With that effectively going away, states are now in a place where they need to put programs in place that can achieve that outcome. With that and with the definitional sets around activities, states really needed to step away and rethink their programs in terms of the client groups that they were serving and how that related to how the TANF program is actually defined. So the governor's budget really comes forward with a proposal that was derived out of many meetings that occurred over the course of the summer and fall, both meetings that were internal to DHS in terms of discussing the effectiveness and weaknesses of the existing program and with external partners and advocacies and legislative members in a TANF oversight committee. That committee made recommendations and that was brought forward. Most of those are included in the governor's budget. And the governor's budget policy package is then supported by House Bill 2180, which is necessary to make the statutory changes. Representative Kotek has also introduced a bill looking to do similar, provide for similar outcomes, although there are some differences between the two bills. As I mentioned earlier, the foster care link is a driver, and of course the Oregon's economy, the job market, general population increases, and so forth. The next chart there is just showing once again how the within self-sufficiency, how the TANF basic program, which is the single parent program, and the UN program, which is the two-parent program, break down funding-wise. The chart on page 29 is looking at just some history with respect to the combined programs. The July 06 value there is 17,600, just as a reference. And in January of this year, the caseload is at 17,898. There are no reductions proposed in this program area in the governor's budget. And so as we move to talk about the policy packages, Some of the discussion that has been had and references made around the amount of investment in the TANF reauthorization, and I just want to clarify that a little in that it's been referred to as an additional $20 million being invested, and that actually is the total investment related to TANF in terms of general fund, but it's actually made up of three different policy packages. Two of the policy packages are actually addressing issues that come out of the base budget development process, and that it's the cost for continuing existing programs. And so what I would like to do, this is often not something we like to do, and that is jump ahead a little and then come back to the TANF reauthorization policy package. So if we went to page 32, policy package 101-9.
We have another 5 minutes left.
Okay. Policy package 101-9 relates to caseload and cost per case changes that really stem from the forecasts and estimates of what those levels would be. And this is really funding that issue in the governor's budget. And similarly, on the next page, which is policy package 101-17, that is backfilling for revenue that is not available in terms of federal funds for the inflationary increases. And so the governor's budget is fully funding the inflationary increase for the TANF basic and UN programs and jobs program with this policy package. So that makes, essentially what that does is make the base estimate whole. And then on the page 34 is policy package 101-new, meaning that they didn't have a number for it apparently. What this policy package is a package that would modify the existing Jobs Plus IEA account and transfer this account to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. The reason for that is to try to improve the access that former Jobs Plus clients have, and also the Student Commission would create a scholarship fund for the clients using money that is referred to as having expired in terms of its availability. So after 5 years, that availability goes away. This would enable them to create a scholarship fund. So with that, where I would come back to then is the 101-4 the next time.
Questions? Senator Bortley?
Madam Chair, not a question, just a comment. That 101-new package follows recommendations, I believe, that came out of the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee from last session, where we spent a lot of time talking about the Jobs Plus program and that education account and the fact that the education account wasn't being utilized as much as it could be. And so I believe this is a follow-up on some of those discussions and recommendations, and that's why we're seeing the shift. Is that correct?
Chair Carter, Senator Gorman, I believe that's
kind of
correct. There was a lot of effort made in the interim to try to increase participation and with little success. So this is taking it that next step, I believe.
Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we've moved past performance measures and now we're into the budget and the policy option packages, before we get too far away from performance measures, in case we don't come back to that, I've been reflecting for several minutes on the discussion from all of my colleagues. And I wonder if you could please report to us at a future time, are there any measures from other agencies or departments that include figures for TANF clients? For example, numbers coming out of education, either high school and vocational ed, or workforce training from the employment division, community colleges, anything that is reported through the Commission on Children and Families from NGOs on service to clients in the counties. Are there any measures happening throughout the state that relate to TANF so that from another perspective we could see successes or failures or improvements? My questions reflect the frustration with there's only so much we can do through this program, only so much we can do through that program, but do the programs ever combine to focus on one segment versus another?
Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson, I can take a general stab at that and then we can come back with some more information, but we can easier track those individuals known to TANF who receive other services within the Department of Human Services. It's a little more complicated when you try to track over to higher education or community college and so forth, because one of the things that you would probably need to know is whether or not that individual disclosed that they were receiving TANF. Sometimes they will, but sometimes that's an issue around privacy, and we always very sensitive to the use of a social security number or something that would be used to do that type of tracking. But we can come back and give you a little more detail on what kinds of things we can track in terms of individuals needing other kinds of services in addition to TANF.
Ms. Baker? Thank you. Members of the subcommittee, I just want to call your attention to the handout that was just given to you. These are responses that the agency has put together from questions that were raised in the department's overview. So if you want to take a look at those, and then if there are questions, those can be discussed in the next couple days.
Thank you very much for your presentation, and thank you for getting back to us on questions asked in the January meeting. Further questions, any other comments?
One other
Senator Marcel.
Comment. I noticed on the number of children in foster home that has decreased. Is that related to our change in meth laws, that we have significantly tightened up on meth houses?
Chair Carter and Senator Marsette. We will talk about that with the child welfare statistics next week, but that decline, you're correct, also reflects a slight decline in the foster care population, not in the number of substantiated abuse and neglects, but in the number of children having to come out of home. And we have been tracing that back to what's been happening with the meth task force and some of the attention to busting meth houses, I guess is the terminology. And there's not as much of that happening now as did in the previous years. So we think that could be a positive sign in terms of us trying to make sure children don't have to come into foster care. So next week you'll see how this slight decrease also parallels a slight decrease in children entering care. But again, we've had an increase in the number of substantiated cases. And so we'll be talking about that in some detail next week.
Please note that your chair didn't keep you 5 minutes late, that Senator Morris said did. No.